Congratulations to everyone. If you are to show that the program works, will everyone with a year or more sober please raise your hand? All right. If you are celebrating an anniversary this month, we invite you to use one of the envelopes on the table in the back to make a contribution to AA's General Service Office. Thank you for letting me be of service.
All right, let's go.
So, guys, my name is Ryan. I'm an alcoholic. Congratulations to all the chip takers, and we especially want to welcome home all of our new friends. We will now observe the seventh tradition. Once Phil gets the basket. The seventh tradition is coming soon. When it is passed, the seventh tradition states that every AA group... Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting. Newcomers and non-AA members need not contribute. You can place papers to be signed in the basket, and Phil's got the basket. He's got a hat, so it's a hat. It's not a basket. And now for the treasury report while the hat is passed. Last week we collected... Somebody in the back, you guys guessed. It's the same people guessing all the time. 5270? One more. We'll get there. We'll get there someday. It was $40.80. And for our expenses, we had $120 that was paid for rent, $40 that we were contributing for chairs, $43.33 for refreshments. That's how important and how much we value the coffee and the cups and the creamer and the sugar. $27 for chips, so at the end of the month especially, everybody can come here and celebrate, and the newcomers can get their chips. Minus a prudent reserve of $275 leaves us with a final balance of $7.59. So, real quick, for those of you that are actually listening but you're not sure what a prudent reserve is, so it's $7.59 plus $275 that we have in our account. We set that aside to make sure that we have money set aside to pay for the facilities, first off. And now we will pass the pink Asian eye can, which will probably be used, we'll probably use a bottle for that. We got a second hat? There it is. We will now pass the pink Asian eye can. Funds collected in this can by literature for those who are unable to attend our meetings. Thank you for your contributions and for letting me be of service.
All right.
My name is Phil. I'm an alcoholic. We are now going to, I'm going to introduce tonight's speaker. There's a lot of things I'd like to say about tonight's speaker. One thing that he is my sponsor. He has a sobriety date of April 11, 2005. He is very active in the fellowship. In fact, he's responsible for starting this meeting that we're here at tonight. About 7 or 8 years ago, I think. He's totally involved in H&I. He has showed me more about Alcoholics Anonymous, I think, than he could ever have taught me. He's a guy that, 2.5 years ago, I was thinking about what I was going to say when I was sitting down, and I thought in my head, 2.5 years ago, I met a man who changed my life. And I thought, well, that doesn't sound really cool. I mean, because I don't want people to get the wrong impression, But you know what? It's the truth. I met this guy, and I listened to some suggestions that he gave me. And in fact, his favorite AA slogan is, if you want what I have, you'll do what I do. And that's what I've been doing for the last 28 and a half months, and my life has completely changed. He has taken me in. He spent time with me. And I mean, he'd come and pick me up for meetings and stuff. He wouldn't even ask me to go. He'd just call me and say, hey, I'll be there in 20 minutes. We're going to the ice house. Boom. And he'd come and get me. And he took time out of his busy life to come and help a guy like me. I know his family. I know his mom personally. I know his wife personally. He knows my mother. He knows my sisters. So not only is he my sponsor, he's one of my best friends. And it gives me great pleasure to introduce Bill Hatzman.
Good evening. My name is Bill Hatzman. I'm an alcoholic. Can you hear me all right? It's tragic. I can't hear myself. I spoke with my sponsor earlier today, as I normally do on Wednesdays, and he encouraged me to do a couple of things. He encouraged me not to try to be somebody else, and he told me to tell the truth. And so, to start that off, I should probably tell you that I've secretly had a resentment against this group for about 7.5 years. My old friend Jim and I got this notion that we wanted to start a speaker meeting here in Visalia. And if I'm being completely honest with you, one of my motives was that I like to speak. And so the resentment that I've had is that I started this group, and I've never been invited to speak before today. And the irony of all that is that I'm the guy that schedules the speakers. So I guess it's my fault that I'm here tonight. I don't get a lot funnier than that, so I hope you'll follow along with me. You know what? My life has been profoundly altered for the better as a result of the things that I have learned about me, that I've learned about you, and that I've learned about a power that has no limits. And I've done that through following a process that's outlined in our big book. And one of the things that I do regularly is participate in a book study meeting. And this book study that we have on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at the Alano Club, it's only a half hour long. And what we do is we read a paragraph out of the book at a time. And then we invite people to ask questions about what we've read. Or even better yet, we invite people to share any experiences that they've had that they feel is related to what we just read. And this process of reading and asking questions and sharing experience has a really peculiar way of helping me to get a deeper understanding of the information that's in this book. And that's one of the many things that has really shaped the life that I live today. And this morning I was in that book study, and you know, as destiny would have it, as providence would have it, as I suppose God would have it, we read something that I felt was perfectly in line with the general direction that I hope to head in this short talk. So I'm going to share this with you. This is from chapter 6, Into Action. It's in the part of the book where they're talking about the ninth step and the amends, and they're giving some very practical advice about how we might approach people we've harmed. And here it goes. There is plenty we should do at home. Sometimes we hear an alcoholic say that the only thing he needs to do is keep sober. Certainly he must keep sober, for there will be no home if he doesn't. But if he is yet a long way from making good to the wife or parents whom for years he has so shockingly treated, passing all understanding is the patience mothers and wives have had with alcoholics. Had this not been so, many of us would have no homes today, would perhaps be dead. The alcoholic is like a tornado, roaring his way through the lives of others. Hearts are broken, sweet relationships are dead, affections have been uprooted, selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil. We feel a man is unthinking when he says that sobriety is enough. He is like the farmer who came out of his cyclone cellar to find his home ruined. To his wife, he remarked, "Don't see anything the matter here, Ma. Ain't it grand that wind stopped blowing?" And you know, that's really, man, that just captures so much of my experience. I want to share with you some stories about some relationships. Before I go any farther, though, I do want to do something that that I have found to be very important for me. When I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and there's literally no explanation for this. My parents had afforded me the opportunity to get a good education, both from a curriculum, you know, educational perspective, as well as a spiritual education. I was afforded the opportunity to go to church Sunday school, for the lack of a better word, and I even attended a parochial school for a number of years. There's literally no reason why what I'm about to tell you should be true, but it was. And what I want to tell you is that when I got here, I felt that I did not know how to pray. And I don't know if any of you may find yourself in that same conundrum, because, you know, one of the things that people tell us around here is that we have to get in touch with a power greater than ourselves. And my understanding of prayer is how I talk to that power. And so if you're struggling with prayer, maybe what I'm about to do next could be helpful to you. If you still bristle at the idea of a God, I'll just ask you to be patient with me while I kind of do my thing. And I would like to share, I'd like to say this prayer. This is a prayer I say commonly, and I'd like to include you in it. So thank you for this opportunity. And I'm going to, Heavenly Father, I want to thank you for another day sober. I want to thank you for all the blessings that you put in my life, and I ask that you would help me to see and to share and to be a good steward with all of them. I pray that you would show me your way for me today, that you would show us your way for us today. I pray that you would give us the courage and the willingness to follow that path. Lord, we pray that all of your children would come to know you, that they would find the love and the peace and the joy and the freedom that we found in you. We pray that you'd use us to help build your kingdom here on earth, and that you would use us to help those in need, especially when we don't want to. Lord, we pray for your healing touch, and for all those who are suffering, we ask that they find comfort in you. It's in your name that we pray. Amen. Relationships. You know, I was a freshman in high school, and actually, I need to go just a step back from there to compare and contrast. I was in seventh or eighth grade, and had my first opportunity to go to a school dance, and I remember the excitement in the air at school that day. Everybody was interested to get to the dance, and I had my eyes on this one particular girl. And I was really interested in seeing her at the dance. I had this notion that she should be mine. I'm not certain that I had any idea what I was going to do with her if I caught her. But I remember, that's the truth. But I remember going home and taking a shower. And I was in seventh grade, so I didn't have anything to shave. But I did use my dad's razor that day against my skin. And I took out my dad's Old Spice or Aqua Velva or whatever it was. And I splashed it on my face. Do you remember how much that hurt the first time you did that? Wowza. And I put on the best shirt that I had and jeans, and I went to that dance that night, and I walked in the room, and I saw her, and she was standing with her friends, and as I walked through the door, I noticed that they were all kind of giggling, and somehow I got the notion that there must be something wrong with me. I thought they must be laughing at me, and so it shook my confidence, and you know, that whole night, I stood essentially with my back against the wall, watching everyone else have a good time and hating every one of them, right? And I don't know about that. I don't know if I hated them, but I was resentful. I was envious. of people that were having the kind of time that I wanted to have. Now, I skip ahead a couple years. Now, I'm a freshman in high school, and some kids that are a couple years older than me, they're on the swim team with me. They pick me up, you know, they're driving age, and so they pick me up, and there's a 16-ounce can, a tall boy, we used to call it, right, a beer in the back seat of the car. And I knew that, obviously, they had been drinking, and I had tasted beer before, didn't really have a taste for it, but I suppose I just wanted to be one of the fellas, right? I just wanted to fit in. And so I asked them if I could have that beer, and they said, sure. And I drank it before we got to the dance. And, you know, we walked into that dance, and I felt like I owned the place. I asked a lot of girls to dance that night. And believe it or not, there were a few that said no. My reaction to them was much different than I feared it might be. Of course, I was convinced that they didn't know what they were missing. But you get the gist, right? It's this beer really helped me to overcome my fear of rejection. It helped me to overcome social anxiety. I thought for sure it made me a better dancer too. That particular night, I got home to my house safely. I didn't get into any fights. I didn't break up with any girlfriends. I didn't spend any money I didn't have. I didn't get sick. There were none of the things that would later be telltale signs of my drinking that took place that night. But it was many years later that I realized that there were two very unfortunate things that happened to me that night. And those two things were that I began to believe a couple of lies. I began to believe that you liked me better when I had a little alcohol in my system. And I didn't want to deprive you. And I also believed that I liked me better. Like I said, I felt like I was a better dancer. I felt I was a little taller. I felt that you know, any acne I might have had at the time was disappeared, and I just felt like a better person. And so, believing those lies from that night on, when I got the opportunity to drink, I took it. My particular circumstance was not one where alcohol was easy to get, so I didn't drink a fifth of Jack Daniels every day for the rest of my life. It wasn't my story. But when I did get the opportunity to drink, I took it. And over a period of many years, my drinking took on greater and greater proportions. And some of the consequences of my drinking also began to take on greater and greater proportions. So, for example, many of you may have this kind of experience where after a long night of drinking, I come to, and I'm not exactly certain where I am or how I got there, right? Or maybe a little less severe than that is. I just wake up the next morning, I think, hey, I had a great time, and then one of my friends calls and says, hey, do you remember? And I don't. You know, I know people that have those kinds of experiences. You know, the kind like the first one I started to tell you about, where I've got to run outside my house and inspect my car right now because I don't really know what happened last night. And I'm afraid of the worst happening. And, you know, there are people that when they have that kind of experience, they just knock it off. They just quit. They go, hey, this is not the kind of mayhem I want in my life. And I don't know that I necessarily want that kind of drama in my life, but I think I suffer from this really convenient ability to forget important things, you know? And so what happens is the people that are around me begin to suffer. And see, I don't really see it. I'm not looking for it either. You know, I got these notions, and I don't think, so far, what I've told you, I don't think, except for the, you know, forgetting stuff, I don't think that I've told you anything that's terribly alcoholic just yet. I mean, I think most humans have some of the things, some of the experiences that I've had. Where I tend to be really different is that I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. When I put it in my system, I just get thirsty. You know, so it's like drinking makes me thirsty, I like to say. And the thing is I'm so self-obsessed and so self-conscious that I really don't see how I'm affecting you. And I get this idea that if I can just get the right job and the right girl and the right car and the right house and all of those things, if I can get just the right combination of those things, then I'll be happy. And so what I do is I go looking for things to make me happy. And I get into relationships with women who I'm convinced are going to make me happy. I got engaged one time to a woman who I thought had many of the things that I was certain were going to make me happy. She had a very impressive career in front of her. She looked just the right kind of way, I thought, and I was convinced that if I could snag her and make her my wife, that I would be happy. And right after I asked her to marry me, I ran into a friend of mine, one of my great friends, and I told him the good news, and he said, "Wow, that's impressive. How long have you known her?" And I said, "Well, I don't know, a few months, I guess, you know." And he goes, "Really? What's her middle name?" And I didn't know. That's the kind of picker I got. I can't even be bothered to find out what her middle name is, right? But I want to make her my wife. You know, over the years, as I said, my drinking would take on greater proportions, and the consequences of my drinking would get greater and greater. And my oblivion to what I was putting other people through also increased. I had no idea how my drinking was affecting other people. I had no idea how showing up just, you know, head-splitting hangover at work, I had no idea how that affected the people that I worked with. You know, my poor performance. I had no idea, for example, that when I was invited to my sister's house for, I don't know, it was Thanksgiving or Christmas, I was actually invited to stay the night in her house because I lived out of town. And one night, I got up in the middle of the night to use the restroom, and apparently, I must have lost my balance while I was in the bathroom, and I managed to knock a picture frame off the wall. And I don't remember doing that, but you know, when you're the only one around, it's got to be you. You know what I'm saying? And so that picture frame fell, and there was glass shattered all over the bathroom floor, and I went back to sleep. I don't consciously remember this happening, but I went back to sleep. And, you know, the thing I need to tell you is that bathroom that I left glass shattered all over the floor was the bathroom right next to my nephew's bedroom. Two little boys who walked around in their house, rightfully so, barefooted. And thank goodness my sister woke up first and found the mess that I had left. And so those boys weren't harmed, but only by an act of grace. And you might imagine my sister was pretty upset with me, as she should have been. And I don't know if you'll appreciate my response, but I kind of laughed it off like it was funny or something. Now, I didn't laugh it off because I didn't care about those boys. I didn't laugh it off because I was trying to harm my sister. I laughed it off largely out of a defense mechanism. You know, one of my great defense mechanisms is humor, or what I call humor anyway. And if I can laugh something off, then I don't have to face the truth about what I've done. And you know, believe it or not, that same sister invited me to come back again and stay the night one time. And one of the things that she said to me before I was unconscious, she said, "Hey, we set our alarm when we go to bed, and so don't open any windows or any doors because it'll set the alarm off." And I said, "Yeah, sure, whatever, sis." And so I get up in the middle of the night again, apparently, and I come back, and apparently I open the window in the bedroom, and then apparently I went right back to sleep. And the alarm's blaring. I don't even know it. I slept through the morning. And I woke up, and again, my sister confronted me with what I had done the night before. And it wasn't hard to tell who had done it, because the window next to where I was sleeping was left open. So there was no, like, well, they did it, you know. You know, it was only years later. In fact, frankly, just a few years ago, when I got a real understanding of what I had put my sister through in those two experiences. My wife and I are fortunate enough to live in a place and a nice home, and we feel more comfortable with a physical sense of security with an alarm. And so when we go to bed at night, we set the alarm. And at about 2:15 one morning, that alarm went off. And I got to tell you, my first reaction was, honey, go see what's out there. Because I don't want to go. I was terror-stricken. Now, it turned out that I had not properly closed the garage door. It kind of serves me right. I didn't quite close the garage door, and so some wind came in and knocked it open, and there was nobody out there. But it wasn't until that I had that experience that I realized, you know, my sister, not only for her own safety, but those two boys that she loves so much. And I made her get up in the middle of the night with the alarm blaring, fearing about who might be in her house, looking to do harm to her and her family. And see, I just laugh stuff like that off. That's the kind of guy I was when I got here. And I want to tell you, that's not the man that I am today. I need to tell you a little bit more about the guy that I was, because I'm going to hopefully tie this together into telling you about how my life has changed. You know, on some of those nights when we would get together as a family and over Thanksgiving or whatever, there would be times when I wasn't staying the night where we were. And it never occurred to me how my mom must have felt when I couldn't barely stand straight and I walked out the front door and got in the car and drove away. Never even crossed my mind that my mom might be concerned for my well-being. And you know, I haven't had the best track record being a grandson either. I spent as much time as I could talking my grandmother out of some pain medication that she had for some physical pain that she was going through. I told her that my pain was certainly very real, and I needed to use some of her pain medication, and I buffaloed her a couple of times. And then there was that day when she wasn't buying it anymore. And so then I started to look for opportunities when Grandma was out of the room to get into her pain medication. And a few weeks or months after that kind of behavior was taking place, my grandmother went to take some of her heart medication, and she was convinced that some of that had been taken as well. And I don't know if you've been paying attention yet, but there's one culprit that I would probably be looking at about now, right? And so, you know, the guy that's standing up on the stage today is the guy that I made my grandmother. I pushed my grandmother into a place where she had to tell my mom that I was no longer welcome at Grandma's house. And I put my poor mom through the shame of hearing that from her mom and then having the task of having to tell me that. And you know, as any good criminal will tell you, it wasn't me. I didn't do it that time. And by the time that did happen, I had actually gotten to a place where I was willing to do things a little bit differently. And I had started taking the steps that my sponsor had been putting in front of me for quite some time. And completely contrary to my personality, my instincts, when my mom called to tell me this news, it occurred to me that that the most respectful thing I could do is just accept the accusation and the consequences that went with it. And it pained me because I was very close with my grandmother, and I'm sure any of you would feel the same way being told that you're not welcome at your grandmother's house. But I knew that that things were slowly beginning to change in my life, and I knew that it was important for me to recognize that I was responsible for this accusation. See, because I'm the one who had behaved in ways that would force the people in my life to look at me as the prime suspect. They didn't do that. I did that. That's a bitter pill to swallow, especially the one time you're innocent, right? But you know, the amazing thing about mothers and grandmothers is they often tend to be grace-filled individuals, and they seem to have this compelling desire to forgive. That, as the book said, just is beyond understanding how we can be forgiven by the people that care the most about us for hurting them the way that we do. But within a short time, I began to be welcomed at my mom's house and my sister's house. And eventually I was welcomed back into my grandmother's house. And you know what you guys did for me? You gave me an opportunity to, in a very small way, give back to my family. It wasn't much longer after that my grandmother, we had to take her driver's license because she was beginning to suffer from some dementia. And we felt it was in her and everybody else's best interest if she not drive. And for about 4 years, because of the things that you guys have taught me, I got the opportunity to take my grandmother grocery shopping every Saturday morning. I got the opportunity to give back to my grandmother in a meaningful way. And after those 4 years was over, my grandmother's dementia had continued to progress, and we had to hospitalize her, and I got to continue on Saturdays to go and visit her. And she passed away recently. It was just a few weeks ago. And I can tell you I was good with my grandmother when she passed. Things had been cleaned up. And I didn't have to hang my head in shame when I saw her or any of my family. And you want to know just how crazy life can be, how I have three perfectly capable sisters, and I have cousins that are perfectly capable, and out of all of the people in my family, I was asked to deliver the eulogy at my grandmother's funeral. And that's the guy that just 10 years ago was banned. You know, the things that have happened in my life are astounding. My mother has also made a point to you guys can be maybe alongside me sometimes questioning her judgment. She's actually asked me to be the executor of her estate when she dies. And you know, again, I just think of all the people that she could choose to be responsible for those affairs, and the fact that she would choose me, I think says a great deal about what Alcoholics Anonymous has done in my life. I want to tell you a little bit also about my wife. I I got married once before. I got past the whole engagement thing. I was engaged three times. I don't think I knew a middle name among any of them, tell you the truth. But I married one of them. And, you know, it turned out that all the things that I thought were going to make me happy didn't make me happy. And I put that poor woman through some very unfortunate times. I wasn't a husband that I would be proud of being. You know, one of the things that I learned from the sex inventory in the fourth step is that I can define an ideal, a sex ideal. And, you know, if you're childish like I can be sometimes, that sounds like, you know, kind of a circus ride, you know, a sex ideal. But what I found that really boils down to is finding the qualities in a partner that I would want to be spending my life with. And, you know, I had never, the types of things that came out of that exercise had never occurred to me. You know, I found out that I wanted to be in a relationship with someone that I could trust explicitly with anything. I mean, even money. And, yeah, I wanted to have a partner in life who shared, at least in a general way, my same spiritual values. I wanted to have a partner in my life who shared my goals for financial. So for example, you know, everybody has their own notion about like how much they want to spend and how much they want to save, right? And how much they want to spend and how much they want to save of what they have. And, you know, these kinds of issues can be really troubling for relationships. I was the kind of guy who really liked to live, I think this makes, if you understand the language here, I like to live on a McDonald's diet, right? But I mean that more in a financial sense than a nutritional sense, although the nutrition's fine too. But I would, and I don't know, you know, if you guys can relate to this, but what I would do is when I would meet a new girl, I would behave in unsustainable ways so that I could win her affection. So I would do things like I would take her to restaurants, you know, like real restaurants, right? And I would bring her flowers, and I would talk to her on the telephone. And I would pay attention when she was saying stuff to me, you know. And I wouldn't wear my underwear around the house, you know. And I didn't wear all those holy shirts that. And you know, as soon as I won her affection, as soon as she, oh goodness gracious, ladies, look out! Don't tell me you love me, because then you're going to get it. You know, at the point that I felt I had won her affection, it was time to get back to the McDonald's. I got no business going to the flower shop. And, you know, I'm going to wear my comfortable old holy shorts. And you know, what I've learned is that I really need to understand what I value in myself and in what I'm looking for in a partner. And just as I had completed writing all of these wonderful things, I basically wrote a description, a job description for my next wife. Right? And believe me, she was quite unattainable. I mean, and I shared that with my sponsor, and you know what he said to me? He said, okay, now we're going to turn that around. Are you trustworthy? Are you, how much do you want to spend? Because you know what I like to do is, if it's something I want, I'll spend the money. If it's something you want, we need to save. Right? And so I've got to turn this around, and I've got to be the guy that's going to attract the woman that I'm looking for. And that was a little bit of a process that took a few years, and I met Suzanne, and we've found something that I didn't think existed. I really enjoy being a part of a partnership with her. You might ask her just to see if I'm telling the truth, or maybe I'm delusional about this. I don't think we've really had an argument. I mean, I'm not trying to be cutesy, right? But we've had different points of view for sure, right? We've had things we didn't necessarily agree on. But I don't think we've ever shouted. We've certainly never withheld ourselves from one another or done any of the other, you know, hallmark things that we do in relationships to get even, right? I mean, that just hasn't been a part of the relationship that I live in. It's only because of the things that I've done here that I've been able to realize the life that I have today. There are so many more relationships that I'd like to tell you about. So many different ways that my life has changed that I'd like to share with you. But fortunately for you, I'm out of time. I do want to be sure to let you know that that my mother is here tonight. She's sitting up here with my wife, and if you would please express your condolences to her. And with that, I'll say thank you very much.
Hey, oi. The Valley Group encourages sponsorship and service to our fellowship. We invite you to come early and stay after the meeting to better get acquainted with our fellowship. If you are a member of our group or wish to contact a member, please be sure to see me. I can add you to our group phone list or get you a copy of it.